I want to start with some health warnings and some disclaimers about what this session is and what it is not. First of all, we are coming to this session from our own personal circumstances, and we should not deny the context from which we're coming to ELF. And I don't want you to do that this morning. But I hope what I'm presenting are things that I think are uncontroversial. Now, if they are controversial, if anything I say is controversial in your mind, I am sorry about that. We can discuss it later. I don't mean to trigger you in any way. What I'm hoping to do is just sort of set out some basic facts and also how the Bible maybe sort of views democracy, or how we can view democracy through a biblical lens. Therefore, if I say anything that you say, is he actually having a go at this politician or that country? No, I'm not. I'm trying to teach broad general principles that you may want to apply into your context. We also, I'm going to go on sort of at the beginning, is to say that we're focusing on democracy this morning. We need to also acknowledge that God doesn't only act in democracies. He is at work, he is sovereign, whatever the system of government is in any nation. And then lastly, I do want us to come away from this morning thinking that those of us who live in what I would term Western democracies, and I'll explain that a little bit more later, that we do have particular blessing and responsibilities that come with that in relation to the freedom of our faith, the freedom of how we express our faith, and how it sort of underpins or sort of reflects some biblical principles. So I just wanted to set that out this morning. So it's not to deny your personal context, and in groups and in pair work, that may come out really strongly and passionately. But I'd also ask you to remember those things that we discussed in the network evening about how do we conduct conversations politically with civility so that we can hold strong convictions, but that does not mean that we can't be compassionate, gracious, and civil and loving with one another in our speech, but also how we listen to one another. So let's start by actually just getting to grips with some of the terminology. State, government, politics, democracy, we sometimes use these terms interchangeably and we sort of get them mixed up. We often think we know what these terms mean, but we don't often stop and take stock about actually what do we think they mean. So in twos and threes, I would love you to sort of to just have a quick discussion about these two questions. When you speak to your friends about democracy, what comes to mind? What does a healthy democracy look like? I'm going to ask for your feedback in a little bit, but before doing that, I just want to go back to those different phrases and those different, well, not phrases, those different words, and sort of really explain what I think they mean. And when I say I think, it's ChatGPT thinks these things. No, it's not. But also lots of reading as well. So one of the ways in which we can think of the difference between the state, government, democracy, and politics is to think about the metaphor or the image of a house. So the state is like the house and everything in the house. So sort of the different rooms, the different furniture. So you could say a definition of the state is the sort of permanent political organization that has sovereignty over a defined territory or population. What that means is that in your country within its borders, the institutions that exist, that is the sort of what makes up the state. Now, that is different, for example, to the government. The government, if we're thinking about that house, if the state is the house, the government is the people in the house that are running it. So they are the sort of people living inside, running it. So the state is the institutions, the territory defined by borders. The government is the people or the party in power who run the administrative functions and the institutions of the state. So whereas the state is pretty permanent in many ways, governments often are, particularly in democracies, temporary. They sort of come and they go and are replaced by others. Democracy is the rules by which sort of the house runs. If you like, the rules of the house is democracy. Sort of, I've got there the tenancy agreement, the lease agreement. So what are the rules by which you gain access to the house? That's sort of democracy in a way. It's the rules by which we participate in the institutions of the state and we decide who lives in the house. And politics is just life together in the house. So if you think about it this way, the state is the institutions, the permanent. The government are the people running the house. Democracy are the rules by which we get access to the house and get in there. And politics is just the everyday life of the house. So I think, all of those are great points. Now, I'm very aware that the CARE group get quite a lot of high-level political theological teaching. They may think that I'm being really simple, sort of when I'm saying. But I think sort of one of the books we encourage them to sort of to read is I can never pronounce. How do you pronounce this theologian's name? Coisus. Okay. So Coisus is a theologian that's written quite a lot about politics, political theory, political theology. And this is just a list of some of the things that he would say are sort of the common characteristics of Western democracies. And lots of these things are, you very clearly and explicitly sort of shouted out and shared. Some of the ones I think are implicit in the points that you made. So these are some of the characteristics of Western democracies. And this is, you could say, some of the sort of signs of what a healthy democracy looks like. But we'll maybe sort of dig into that a bit deeper in a little bit. And before really thinking about how does democracy line up against some really important fundamental biblical principles, I just wanted to ask the question, this is a rhetorical question, I'm not actually asking you and asking you to sort of give me answers right now, but is democracy better than any other form of government? Well, again, sort of thinking about that question, another theologian says this: democracy is a product and a protector of freedom. It presupposes the freedom of speech and assembly, a means of transfer of power through elections. We've had these points made, that human rights are bound to be respected by the state, and religious freedom. It requires a free market economy. I could debate that. Christian faith is linked with freedom and democracy. Is the protector of freedom. I guess the question I'm sort of saying is that often we think that democracy is sort of naturally sort of a biblical model, but often it's sort of intertwined, it's mixed up with lots of other deeply held beliefs that we may have. So we may think that democracy is brilliant because it empowers the individual. Now, we're going to look at a bit that is a biblical principle. Why I wanted to show that quote is because you may agree entirely with every part of that quote. But also, some may be thinking, well, is democracy and a market economy, do they have to exist together? Now, I think that we can debate that. I'm not opening that up to question, Lynn. That's too controversial for the amount of time I have left this morning. But I think we need to be really careful sometimes in that we have our own beliefs and idols that are not always biblically based. It's not to say they're in contradiction with biblical principles, but we need to be careful sometimes that sometimes we have our own deeply held beliefs that are not not always rooted in biblical principles. What I said before, I just want us to remember that we bring lots of our own baggage, our own idols to these conversations. And we think that sort of from those of us living in Western democracies that are, let's say, relatively healthy, that this is the best form of government and we're sort of, but actually God does work through different political systems, doesn't he? We can probably think of those examples right now. Thinking about how did God use Nebuchadnezzar with Daniel? How did God use Artaxerxes with Nehemiah? How did Esther influence Xerxes? Even how did Joseph work with Pharaoh? And controversially, maybe, even though Rome persecuted the early church, actually, in some ways, you could say the stability of the Roman Empire allowed Paul and the early apostles and evangelists and early church to spread the gospel through the Roman Empire. So there's sometimes a sort of a good and a bad in some of these regimes as well, and sort of different forms of government. And even where we look back in history and we think, well, you know, the examples I've given is where you can see God doing good through a leader that was not following God at the time. But even in circumstances where we would find it hard to see God at work. So think about the Pharaoh that Moses dealt with, or think about Jezebel, or think about Herod. Those were rulers overseeing a system of government that not only wasn't following God, but was actively persecuting followers of God and God's people. And we would no way say those were sort of good or benign forms of government. And yet actually we see through the Bible narrative, don't we, that God is at work, God is sovereign, and even in horrible, let's say, sort of, this is a nice sort of English sanitized word, even in challenging circumstances, whatever the government structure, God is sovereign, God is at work. Even when we see suffering going on, it doesn't mean God is absent. It doesn't mean that God can't work through that government system. But I do think, for the purpose of this morning, that we may have our own personal idols. We may think that democracy is the only real way in which we can sort of we can see God at work. I do think that democracy does actually reflect some really important biblical principles. So I want to begin with thinking about how does democracy reflect some of the creation principles we see in Genesis chapter 1 and 2. I'm going to go through some that I hope may have been reflected, and I'm not saying I've got a comprehensive list. I'm not infallible, but if there are things that you want to sort of come and talk to me about later, that would be great. I was going to use as a basis of the first point, I think, is that in Genesis 1 and 2, chapters 1 and 2, we see God create a good creation and think about how he wants people to steward that creation. Some of the points I'm going to sort of raise now, reflected in that quote by a UK politician, a guy called Tim Farron. He was leader of the third biggest national party in the UK for a while, but resigned partly because of controversy that he was an evangelical Christian and his views on sexuality that were sort of honed in on by the media. And actually, in some ways, you could say that's liberated him post-resigning to be actually a lot more open and free about sort of talking about his faith. So I will leave you to read that quote I'll just pick out a few things that I think you may have sort of touched upon. So, for example, just the very fact that we are created with equal dignity, aren't we? Every person is equal in God's sight in that way. So one person, one vote. There's an equality there in that sense. There's a responsibility. We as human beings are placed over creation and in creation and over creation to be stewards. Now, actually, you could say that participating in democracy, using your vote, is actually a way of reflecting the fact that you need to take responsibility that God has given you over how we organise our common life together. So actually, voting is a responsibility that is an echo of the stewardship responsibility that we have as human beings. Have you thought that actually democracy is a way of actually bringing us into community with one another? Actually, democracy, we are built for relationship. We are built to be, we're created to be in community with one another. And actually, democracy is a form in which we are pushed together to have a dialogue about what does life together look like and how do we want to organise that. There's a book that I've just finished reading by, now I always get, he's got three names and they're all sort of first names and I always mix them up, but it's James Hunter Davison. He's a sociologist, but an academic from a Christian perspective as a sociologist. And his book is on democracy and solidarity. And one of the very interesting things he says in that book is that often in democracies, we talk about consensus. And he said, actually, consensus is a very rational, secular phrase. And actually, the more deeper biblical concept is solidarity. What is it that binds us together as human beings, as communities, as nations? And so let's not sort of be satisfied with consensus when it comes to democracy. Let's look for what are the bonds of solidarity that bind us together. Now, democracy is not always the answer to that. Sometimes, as we will think about later on, it polarizes us. You know, there's a tendency to do that as well. But democracy can be an expression of our solidarity together. And that solidarity, I think, is rooted in a biblical concept of we are made to be in relationship with one another and have some shared, we have some shared characteristics as humans, don't we? That we sort of innately are designed to be in relationship, that we innately have an idea of fairness and justice. But also, I think that there are some shared values that we can sort of cultivate as human beings as well. And that's the solidarity that binds us. And Tim Farron there also sort of alludes to not just chapters 1 and 2 of Genesis, but forward into chapter 3, when we see the fall of Adam and Eve, and how democracy also sort of enables us to think about the biblical concepts of accountability. Now, the Bible talks about accountability to our Creator, to God, but also there's a sort of thought about, well, what does it mean to be accountable to one another as well? One of the points earlier that was raised was actually David talked about power on Monday. Democracy is a way of dispersing power. And actually the biblical sort of the way that creation was created good is that power wasn't concentrated, you know, wasn't designed to be concentrated in any one person. It was dispersed. We are all, you know, we are all created in the image of God. That means we are created as powerful beings. Imitating our God. And actually democracy is a way of dispersing that so that some people aren't take power, we aren't sort of disempowered and other people are powered. It's a way of sort of spreading that power. So we do think about not just the biblical principles we see in Genesis 1 and 2, but thinking about what are the effects of the fall in Genesis 3 and how does democracy help us reflect the reality of living in a sinful and broken world. Now, it is a trendy thing to do, isn't it, to quote C.S. Lewis in any talk. I came across this quote, which I think is really interesting, because if Tim Farron, for example, like many Christians, are starting from democracy is a reflection of God's good creation and who we are called, who are we created to be as sort of stewards over creation, equal in God's sight. C.S. Lewis goes straight to Genesis chapter 3, and think about how democracy helps us live in a world that is sinful and broken. So I'll read the quote out for you. I am a Democrat, not because I believe, and that's a small d for the Americans, not a big D. I'm a Democrat because I believe in the fall of man. I think most people are Democrats for the opposite reason, which is the Tim Farron quote. A great deal of democratic enthusiasm descends from the ideas of people like Rousseau, who believed in the democracy because they thought mankind was so wise and good that everyone deserved a share in the government. The danger of defending democracy on those grounds is that they're not true. And whenever their weakness is exposed, the people who prefer tyranny make capital out of the exposure. I don't deserve a share in governing a hen roost, much less a nation, nor do most people. All the people who believe in advertisements and think in catchwords and spread rumours, the real reason for democracy is just the reverse. Mankind is so fallen that no man can be trusted with unchecked power over his fellows. Aristotle said that some people were only fit to be slaves. I do not contradict him, but I reject slavery because I see that no men are fit to be masters. It's a really revealing quote, isn't it? That actually, again, I think in the world today, particularly in the West, where we want to default to the goodness of mankind or humans, and sort of that sort of Genesis 1 and 2, we have to remember that we live in a world after Genesis 3 until Christ returns. And so democracy is good because it understands the sinfulness and brokenness of the world, but also of the individual human heart as well. So let's go back to that idea of, is democracy better than any other form of government? Well, on one hand, I could argue, and I hope I've given a case to saying it, you can argue that it is a very good form of government because it both reflects biblical principles, and as we'll see in a little bit, we can sort of maybe live out our Christian faith in a way that is maybe not possible under other forms of government. But I also want to sort of to remind us that it's not just that other forms of government, God can work through other forms of government, but sometimes our sinful hearts long for other forms of government, however good and appropriate we think democracy is. Do you remember Israel and when they longed for a king? So God said, I'm sending you into this amazing land that I've promised you. Everything that you need to lead a good life is there ready and waiting for you. And part of you being different and distinctive and a light to other nations is you're not going to be like them and have a king that rules autocratically and gathers power into him and his family's sort of orbit. I'm going to ask you to live life in this good land in your tribes and without that one person concentrating power and telling you how to live your life, because you will follow me. I am your God. You don't need a king. And what happened? The people longed to be like other nations. And so it wasn't just envy of, oh, what's going on in other countries? But there was something actually deeply in their heart, wasn't it? That actually they just wanted God's, you know, I guess for many of them, like us sometimes, God feels a long, long way away. And it's easier to sort of see a real physical person in front of us to tell us, like, oh, everything will be okay. I will take care of everything for you. So we need to remember that even when democracy, we understand in our heads that it is good and it reflects biblical principles, sometimes the human heart can long for something else. A theologian called Luke Bretherton said that the human heart always seems to lean towards tyranny, and that can take two forms. It can either be the traditional form that we probably are thinking in our heads of the authoritarian ruler that sort of rules the country. But I want to suggest that even in a democracy, we can have a form of tyranny, which is the tyranny of the majority over the minority. And one of the sort of challenging things of us as Christians is that when we think about, I actually don't think personally that human rights is a terrible thing that we sort of should discredit because they have biblical roots. But as Christians, we're always called to look out for the rights of the other person, not ourselves. And that's where sometimes modern society has twisted things, that we always want to talk about our own rights rather than defend the vulnerable, the marginalized, the disenfranchised. So sometimes, even in democracies, there can be a tyranny of the majority over the minority. Democracy is, after all, a way of showing neighborly love in the way that we cast our vote and the way that we use the privilege of freedom of expression and freedom of religion. So two quotes to end this section. Two theologians whose surnames begin with N. And the first one is just the warning that I've sort of tried to make, sort of give you a case to say, actually, we can defend democracy on biblical grounds. It is actually potentially a really good form of government for us as Christians to operate and live within. But we can also make democracy our idol. Again, a sort of catchphrase or soundbite here is we need to always remember that democracy is a system, not a creed. Do you understand the difference? That actually it's a system that is useful and beneficial for us to live our lives and to live out our faith. But it should never become our idol. We defend democracy not because we believe democracy is perfect or the thing that we should strive for. We defend democracy or work to maintain democracy because of what it enables us to do and who it enables us to be. And I love this final quote, and this sort of ends this section of the talk, from Niebuhr. And I think this gives a really lovely way of encapsulating why I think I personally think that democracy is a really important thing to defend and maintain, because man's capacity for justice makes democracy possible, but man's inclination to injustice makes democracy necessary. So it's thinking of Genesis 1 and 2, but also Genesis 3 as well. Now, I'm going to go through the next section, which is potentially the controversial bit of this morning, thinking about how democracy is threatened. I'm going to go through a few slides, and then I'm going to sort of get us to split back into sort of twos and threes to sort of discuss which of these you may think is most relevant to your context and how it looks and how it manifests itself into your context. Because I think we need to realize that whilst there may be some countries where, for example, I in the UK can look at other countries around the globe and say, oh yes, democracy is being threatened there, and I can tell people of those countries how I think it's being threatened. There have been numerous reports and research in the UK about how democracy is under threat in the UK as well. So I need to be really careful to not point out the splinter in another nation's eye when there may be a plank in my own. And my context and my case for saying that democracy is under threat, I'll go through some of the sort of ways in which I think is under threat in a minute. But if I just look at some basic statistics, and I'll start with the UK and then I'll broaden it out. So there's an organization, Carnegie, who did some research in the UK, and it found that only 45% of people in the UK think that democracy is working well. 76% of people don't trust our MPs, and 73% of people don't trust government. There's wider research done by the polling company Mori, and they found that only 9% of people in Britain trust politicians to tell the truth. 9% trust politicians to tell the truth. 33% were satisfied with democracy. 39% were dissatisfied. There's a wider than sort of multinational survey around Gen Zs or Zs, however you want to pronounce it. And again, there was country breakdown. But even, and I'm saying this because I just want to sort of say that even as a UK, I cannot stand here and say I'm preaching to you as sort of somebody who lives in a great, healthy, thriving democracy, because there are statistics like this one, that Gen Z trends and trust in democracy. 52% of those aged between 18 and 25 believe the UK would be better run by a strong leader unfettered by parliament and elections. An international survey by the Elderman Trust in 2025, earlier this year published, found that globally, 61% of people were either had moderate or high levels of grievance against democratic governments. And the reason why, and we'll come on to this in a little bit, was partly because when they sort of asked why you sort of have a moderate or high level of grievance against the government, in lots of nations, it was because either the government was not listening to and reflecting the priorities of the majority of people, or because they felt actually the government was there to benefit the rich and the powerful, not the average person. So there are many ways in which democracy is under threat because of a decline in trust in democracy as a system and the democratic institutions that exist in countries. Now, I think we can break that down, I think, into two parts. First of all, I think there's a decline in trust in democracy and democratic institutions for ideological reasons. Now, I sort of mentioned, for example, the tyranny of the majority, populism, nationalism, individualism, materialism, nihilism. James Hunter Davison in that book says, actually, the greatest threat to democracy is not polarization, it's nihilism. And he sort of goes into sort of talking about Nietzsche, for example, talked about nihilism, and there's passive nihilism and active nihilism. Passive nihilism has existed for decades, and sociologists have been writing about it a lot. So passive nihilism is things like in our societies that sort of more and more people are feeling isolated, alienated. There's a breakdown in relationships and communities. But more and more we're seeing active nihilism, which is sort of often in sort of countries we see people have this sort of what's been called ethic of woundedness, sort of the sense that they are being injured or caused harm by institutions or governments or other groups. And sort of that then breeds sort of an ethic of revenge in sort of people. So there are ideological reasons, theoretical reasons, which we see sort of being borne out, where particularly in countries where the sociologists are saying that communities are being replaced by interest groups. So where we used to have communities that were people of different backgrounds and sort of held different beliefs, sort of coming together and mixing together, almost forced to get along with one another. You could say a bit like churches. And they're being replaced by interest groups, which are narrow and niche and sort of say, this is, you know, we're bound together by similar beliefs and desires and wants. And everybody else who doesn't agree with us is against us. If you're not for us, you're against us. So communities are being replaced by interest groups. And that sort of that's underpinned by this idea of nihilism. But there are also practical reasons, I think, why there's a declining trust in democracy. And again, there's numerous sort of reports out, sort of international surveys. I've obviously, in my research for this, focused on the ones written in English, because I'm a typical British person. Well, I'm not a typical British, but I'm Welsh, so I speak Welsh and I speak English. But I'm typically British in I only speak those two languages and I haven't learned French or Spanish or Italian or any sort of the other languages represented in this room. But there are international studies on this. And time again, the things that people are sort of saying that they sort of are, have declining trust in democracy and democratic institutions is because governments are failing to deliver economic prosperity. One of the key turning points often in different national surveys is the response to COVID-19 pandemic and actually how governments responded to the pandemic. One of the really good historic measures that people use about sort of about the state of society, but also how governments are doing, is when you ask people, do you think that your children will grow up to be more prosperous than you are? And the numbers of that have just gone down. And those of you under 30, you're probably living that right now, I'm sorry. There's just a general idea that actually democratic governments are not delivering what people want. And this contrast is that sometimes people are looking at saying, well, are sort of other systems of government really better suited to deal with sort of the long-term big picture challenges, whether it's the environment or economic growth or whatever it is, that actually democracy is short-termist and actually sort of, when you don't have the problem of elections and holding politicians to account, you can take long-term and sometimes unpopular decisions for the greater good or for the long-term good. We also need to realise that democracy is under threat because of some foreign powers trying to influence sort of Western democracies. Again, I suspect there may be sort of in different countries, this may have been discussed in official circles more than others. But I know in the UK, there's quite a lot of work being done by members of parliament and people in the House of Lords. So there are parliamentary reports on this as well as sort of academic reports on this. And in the UK, we are certainly saying that the threat is coming from mainly from Russia, from China, and to a lesser extent, Iran. And the nature of that takes different forms, but some of the phrases that sort of people discuss in terms of sort of the impact of foreign powers on the UK is that sort of it's like poison in the system, or it's like a virus in the system. So it's not that they're actually directly attacking, but it's sort of infiltrating and sort of trying to kill it from the inside like a disease. Now, in other parts of the world, it won't be so sort of subtle, if I put it that way. The threat to democracy is far more physical and direct through physical force and power. But we need to understand that that is a threat to democracy. And there's a threat to democracy that all the sort of the research and the sort of surveys say coming from technological developments and digital challenges. And I think that can be broken down into two parts as well. One is actually how technology sort of helps the spread of misinformation and disinformation. Again, I suspect that particularly in the larger groups, there will be people that will talk direct experience of encountering that. And the dangers, if you like, of not just sort of the Russias and the Chinas sort of trying to sort of put things on TikTok or Facebook or whatever it is, but actually how technological companies, their algorithms, reinforce the echo chambers in that sense and amplify the problem. I also just wanted to touch briefly, though, on, because I think when we think of technology, we're thinking about that orange square. But I also wanted you to think about the role of technology in the blue square and the fact that there's been a number of studies recently, sort of both sort of on the general population, sort of in lots of countries saying, sort of what's one of the problems of democracies? Well, it's we haven't got good leaders. And the reality is that there are lots of good people who would make fantastic leaders who do not want to go into politics or go into the public square because of the abuse that they will face. I mean, I ran for parliament in 2005 and I had a really difficult campaign where there were lots of attacks, but that was really before social media was a big thing. And I can only imagine what the sort of my campaign would have looked like in today's world, 20 years later. You know, it was this sort of almost the sort of transition from analog to digital world. So, you know, sort of there were much more posters of me with the word fascist written across my face than there were sort of tweets about me. But today, with technology, the spread of misinformation, but also just the spread of abuse and intimidation. So CARE works with lots of members of parliament and people in the House of Lords. One of the really strong observations I've made is that you could say that the older politicians are closer to retirement and they don't care. That they sort of, they've like, oh, I'm coming to an end. I've got my pension. I can say what I want. But and that may be part of the reason why older politicians may be more open and talking about their faith when they're sort of in the political sphere. But I do think there's something about the younger members of parliament, not just being early on in their career or being in more marginal seats, but actually more influenced by social media, more sensitive to social media. And we know that as soon as they support something that CARE is advocating, they will get abuse online from outside of their party, but also within their party as well. Particularly on the left, but not exclusively on the left. We know that sort of people on the left, you know, oh, how can you possibly align yourself with that fundamentalist, sort of crazy pro-choice sort of anti sort of gay, you know, anti same sex sort of relationship sort of organization. And so they just sort of keep quiet. Not everybody, and there are some amazing politicians. Think of creative ways to be faithful in the public square. But we also need to understand that technology is playing an active part in dissuading good people from going into politics and from good people being public leaders. And so we need to remember that. I'm going to suggest that we come back to this question, because I'm going to go rattle through some slides now about what can we do to defend democracy. And then we're going to come back after the break to answer that question, and another one then about what can we do ourselves. Defending democracy. Again, these are my thoughts based on the reading and the conversations I've had. I would hope that the collective creativity inspiration of this room may come up with other thoughts. And I'm only going to use the headlines here, not going to sort of, you know, there are long lists I could sort of rattle off underneath this. Very formally, we can think, are there reforms to the system and to our laws that would actually make democracy healthier? So are there reforms around transparency and thinking about political donations and political influence that could help? Are there sort of civic education programs around democracy that we should sort of be advocating and promoting? Are there just reforms to democratic institutions that make them more effective and actually respond to people's needs better? Adaptability and creativity. And what I was thinking about with this slide particularly was around the technology point. Actually, we should not be as Christians saying, oh yeah, technology is a threat and being used for bad purposes and for dark purposes, and therefore we should avoid technology. Let's think about, as Christians, about how we can be creative and adapt to what this world is and looks like. And how do we use some of these forms and technologies for good rather than for evil? Or how do we use some of these, how are we creative in thinking about sort of how we promote democratization of the media, of government institutions, of how we collect and respond to voters' viewpoints? How can we use technology and how can we be creative about the institutions in a way that reflects the current world and future needs, not sort of moving backwards? What part do we play in building trust in these institutions and in the system? And I think when we sort of think about how can we promote trust, we don't deny that there may be problems with democracy and democratic institutions in some of our contexts. But we also have a role to play to saying, actually, there may be problems. What do we need to sort them out? But we also believe in the system fundamentally as well. How do we make sure that when we go into the public square, that we are not conforming to that statistic that said that there are people that think that only 9% of people think that politicians tell the truth? So if we are people of truth, how are we undermining that statistic and promoting trust in the public square? That requires participation. There is a theologian, author, podcaster called Matthew Kemenick, whose podcast is called Zealots at the Gate, that he does with a Muslim friend of his. He's coming to the UK. He's coming to Poland, I think, in 2 weeks' time. And then on his way back to America, he's going to stop off in the UK, and we've grabbed him as care, and he's going to do a lecture for us on how democracy is a way of life. Again, I think that sometimes we think our democratic responsibility is to vote every few years. Well, actually, democracy is a far more active thing. We have to sort of actively participate in it, to underline. So how are we sort of participating in that Jeremiah chapter 29 idea of we're exiles, but we are still called to seek the welfare of the city that God has placed us in? And relationships. Actually, how are we developing relationships where we are countering that trend of communities fading and interest groups rising? How are we crossing boundaries and listening to people? Again, sort of in preparation for this talk, you sort of you get taken off by the YouTube algorithm into weird and wonderful little alleyways sort of the internet. And so there's a whole sort of set of talks I started listening to around conspiracy theories. And again, the general wisdom around if somebody that you know or a friend or you encounter sort of believes in a conspiracy theory, the wisdom is like, don't try to fact check that conspiracy theory, because that just instantly puts somebody into a defensive posture. Actually, take time to listen and understand why they believe in that conspiracy theory, what is driving them. There's an author called David Brooks, who's a New York Times columnist, who's sort of written best-selling books, and he says that moral renewal begins with attending to somebody else. The power of attention brings change in both sides. It is a Christ-like thing, or it is a Jesus-like thing, to look at the other person through Jesus' eyes. So you are looking at somebody else who's made in the image of God, not the other or the enemy. But then lastly, I want to suggest that if democracy is a way of life that we have to participate in defending and enriching and cultivating, we have to think about the way that we do that has to be done in a Christ-like way. So those ideas of sort of misinformation or sort of the ways in which sort of people try to undermine or threaten democracy, we are not called to fight the world's powers with the world's methods. We are called to think about how we are Christ-like in being democratic citizens. So we should not conform to the patterns of the world of sort of spreading our own conspiracy theories about the other. We should not retreat into our interest groups. We should think about actually how we're crossing boundaries into communities. We should be thinking about the tone of our discourse. So when we're thinking about all of these things, let's not sort of retreat to saying, well, we know from the world these tactics are really powerful and successful. We actually sort of stand against that. I'll finish with just two stories. One is Daniel, and then the other one is my own. So Daniel, I love sort of looking back at Daniel chapter 1. And it's a familiar, you know, when he and his friends are taken into exile, and he sort of draws the line. He's taken into exile. You know, he could have resisted and been killed, but he was taken into exile. He gets his name changed. He gets recruited into the civil service of sort of the conquering nation, Babylon. But he draws the red line at food. And there's lots of discussion because they're not even kosher sort of rules that he follows, but he draws a line. Now, there's a wonderful way in which, like, how does he go about that, sort of convincing his overseer, sort of why this is a good idea and why he should be allowed to. But I guess my point is that he drew the line. He knew he wasn't going to go beyond. He wasn't going to do things that would compromise him and his character and his sort of spiritual well-being. And I always sort of reflect that was the beginning of Daniel's spiritual formation. Because we always think that, oh, I love the Daniel of the lion's den. Or I love the story of the friends and the fire. Or I love the sort of, you know, and all of those. So those would not have been possible unless Daniel cultivated his own spiritual formation from a very early stage. The small acts that you do will result in you being faithful in the big things you're called on to do. What did that look like in my life? Well, I told you that I ran for Parliament in 2005. The small thing that I did was that one of the things you do in the UK is door knocking. And one of the days that you know people are going to be in is Sundays. So Sunday's a really big door-knocking day for lots of local campaigns. But actually, I said to my team, Sunday's my Sabbath. I'm not a Sabbatarian, but I needed rest after the week. So I said, I'll do the campaign group meeting in the morning, and then I'll go across the road to the church I'm attending in the constituency, and then the rest of my day is with my family. And I said, I'm not going to tell anybody else to do, but I want to set that as a role model example, and I think it'd be good for you all to have a rest at some point. So that was a tone I set. But also, the other big thing in that campaign was that my opponent wasn't below using dirty tactics against me. So there were lots of lies told about me during that campaign. some to do with my faith. So he went on TV, did a big sort of national TV interview in Wales, where he basically sort of said, everybody knew he was gay, but he had not officially come out. He said he had to come out as somebody who had same-sex attraction because his Labour opponent, me, was an evangelical Christian running a homophobic campaign against him. It was the time of Tony Blair and the Iraq sort of war. And so he said, oh, he's a warmongerer. He's really in favor of war. There were lots of things like that sort of said about me. Now, as you can probably imagine, there were people, he grew up in that local community. People knew his life very well, both in that community and in London. And there were lots of stories that came to me that would have reflected very badly on him. Now, I don't know if those stories were true or not. They had a ring of truth in them. But there was a decision I had to make of, do I use those stories or do I not use those stories? Now, I decided not to use them because I was not willing to go down that route of, because it would say something more about me than it would him if I went down that. Now, I went into the campaign thinking, lots of you are too young to remember the TV program, The West Wing. But it was about a Democratic president who was this idealistic sort of Democratic president where all policy sort of, the good policies win the day, good arguments win the day. And I went into policy thinking, politics is like The West Wing, and it's not like The West Wing. Righteousness and good arguments do not always win the day. But it was important for me to say, I am not willing to go down that route, even if it means I don't win. If I'd have said lies about him or used those dirty tactics to smear his character, I don't know if I'd have won or lost. But it would have said something, it would have eroded my relationship with God, because it was something I was willing to do to achieve a goal that was not promised. I had a real sense of calling from God that I was to run the race. I was never told that I was going to win. And so when I didn't win, I could not be angry with God because I said, God, I know that you wanted me to run. I'd have loved to have won, but that's not what you promised me. And I've come away. There were lots of mistakes I did in that campaign. But those two things that I did, I'm glad that I did. I'm glad for myself, but I'm glad because of the witness it showed to others. But it's an example of how we all have to make decisions in the small and the big around how we conduct ourselves if we are to support and promote democracy and democratic institutions that I think are an echo of many good biblical principles.